Yesterday was the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, November 11th, 1918, and we spent a lot of last week talking about that celebratory moment when the war finally ended. But this is also another somber anniversary worth remembering. In 1918, a flu epidemic also hit Kansas City, resulting in 2,000 deaths. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're going to start today's show with a look back on the flu 100 years ago. And then we'll talk about the flu season that's just begun, including whatever questions you have about how it spreads, how to prevent it, and how medicine is maybe equipped to handle something like it differently in 2018. For now, Sue Sykes-Barry, formerly with UMKC's Health Sciences Library, good morning.
Good morning.
You wrote your graduate thesis about the flu pandemic of 1918 in Kansas City. Why was that?
Well, I'm a nurse in addition to being a librarian and a historian, so I was very interested in the medical aspects of the pandemic.
So this was nationwide, but Kansas City was hit especially hard, right?
Well, Kansas City was hit very hard because of the politics involved.
Whoa. Tell me more.
Yes. Well, the city was divided into two camps, Tom Pendergast's camp and Joe Shannon. And they each got to appoint 50% of the city workers. So since they were rivals, a Shannon worker wouldn't necessarily cooperate with a Pendergast worker. So the health department was set up the same way. And so there was quite a bit of lack of cooperation, we might say.
So every city department was split in half,
yes,
including the health department.
Yes.
As a really lethal, it turns out, really lethal,
yes,
flu virus is spreading through the city.
Right. And plus, Tom Pendergast controlled saloons. And saloons were, when they did finally get around to putting in a quarantine, saloons were exempt. They just let them stay open because nobody wanted to challenge Tom Pendergast.
So it became a problem both to deal with the spreading virus and then also to kind of manage people's behavior around it because there was a lot of tiptoeing around this one powerful guy.
Right, right.
Okay, well, what kind of numbers are we talking about? 2,000 deaths, but can you kind of put that in context?
Well, I can. Historians are still arguing over how many people actually died in the world, but they used to say 50 to 100 million. Now they're saying closer to probably to 500 million.
And then 2,000 of those here in Kansas City. And I'm thinking the population of Kansas City was smaller back then?
Yes, it was 234,000, right around there.
That's pretty crazy. So was it sort of like a situation where, like, everyone knew someone who died of the flu?
Oh, yes, yes. The whole city. Undertakers didn't have enough coffins. Embalmers couldn't get the bodies done. It was really a nightmare to be here in that time.
Just how, aside from like the business of death and undertaking and sort of funereal things, how disruptive was the flu outbreak to other aspects of daily life in the city? Were things shut down? Or?
Well, they tried to have a quarantine and they tried to have the businesses shut down. But you have to remember that the war is still going on. So anything war-related was exempt. Liberty Loan lunches where you would, it sounds like you paid 10 cents and you got a lunch and that was your donation for the war. those continued, parades continued, troops were still moved around.
How knowledgeable was the medical establishment back then? Did they know what caused the flu,
no,
how to prevent it?
No, they had no, they didn't know what caused it and they had no treatment. The best treatment you could get was good nursing care. And the Visiting Nurses Association, they have records that show that they treated 2,300 some people and they only had 35 deaths in that number. So good nursing care really did make a difference.
Why do you think that would be? I mean, just the ability to keep an eye on someone, keep them hydrated, that
yes,
kind of thing?
Yes, fluids, you know, because they had no antibiotics for the secondary infections. They weren't even sure. There was still the miasma theory of disease was popular.
What's that?
Where bad air causes disease. There's a chemical theory where things called zymes were the cause of disease. The doctors didn't agree on what was the cause.
So even something as basic as hand washing was not necessarily agreed upon.
No. Now, the Red Cross did push gauze masks. So certain companies in town would provide the material, and the Red Cross would make masks for their workers. But they were not, the flu virus is pretty tiny, so it wasn't.
So a mask wouldn't necessarily help a whole lot, especially if you're not washing your hands.
Right.
Who specifically died in this outbreak demographically? Was it the elderly or?
No, it was actually the young, the people who should have been most able to recover.
Young meaning what exactly?
Oh, anywhere from 25 to 40. So it was people in the prime of their lives.
Any sense of why that would be?
Well, they think that what happened was the body would go into a hyper response and it would just kind of overreact to the what was happening.
And maybe it's who was going to those saloons?
Could be.
Well, so, okay, I'm talking to Sue Sykes-Barry. She's an expert based on a thesis she wrote on the flu pandemic of 1918, which hit Kansas City really, really hard, partly because of politics, partly because of what we knew and didn't know about the flu itself. But it sounds like politics had a lot to do with Kansas City as compared to elsewhere. And along those lines, Sue, were there mistakes that people learned from or should have learned from?
There was a lot of things they should have learned from. I don't know that they did.
What are some of those things other than don't be politically divided?
Yeah. Quarantine did work. St. Louis had a very strict quarantine, and St. Louis had about half the death rate that we did. Kansas City, Kansas, and the whole Kansas side, they had a better response because they weren't politically divided.
So even just across a state line, that because it seems like it's hard to keep people just cross state lines pretty freely in the city now. I don't know.
They did then, too. And so, but still, Kansas City, Kansas did a better job of closing establishments and closing schools. And the schools in Kansas City, the superintendent wanted to close them, and the health department told him he couldn't.
So in Kansas City, Kansas, where the schools did close, how did that work? I'm imagining all of these parents.
That part I don't know.
I guess probably a lot more households had a parent at home.
I would guess, yeah.
So then in Kansas City, Missouri, there was the health department is allowed to tell the schools they can't shut down?
Well, not officially, but it all became, it was so political.
Why would saving people's lives from the flu be political?
Because Tom Pendergast and the majority of the people who ran the Democratic machine were business owners. The Bernard Kerrigan, who ran the streetcars, he didn't want the streetcars shut down. He didn't want them limited to 20 people. You know, it was a business. It was a business decision.
Did businesses suffer through this time? Or the economy sort of more broadly?
No, because the war was going on. So I don't think there was a whole lot of... I mean, movie theater owners complained because they had to close, but I didn't read anything about anybody going out of business.
As a nurse, what interests you about the political piece of the story? Is that something that you can relate to as someone who's provided that kind of care?
Well, in a way, it was just that, I lived through I was a nurse during the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, and politics comes into play no matter what you're doing. And I think you just have to be aware of it.
Yeah, people like to think that their choices that they're making are these personal choices and that everyone's looking out for everyone's best interests.
Yeah, but we aren't always.
You know, I'm curious from you, when you think about the flu today, do you ever think about this pandemic in a way that you think people should be remembering more?
Well, it's always a good idea to remember your history so you don't repeat those mistakes. But I think we've come so far from this flu. You know, vaccines have been a wonderful, wonderful invention. And they tried vaccines then. They were experimenting with some of them, but they didn't really know.
If you don't know what causes the flu, it's hard to prevent it with a vaccine.
Exactly.
Or anything else.
Exactly.
Well, Sue Sykes-Barry, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
When KCUR's Central Standard returns, what do we know about the flu today? And what can we say about the current flu season so far? Call 816-235-2888 with your questions. An infectious disease specialist joins us in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we just heard about the flu epidemic of 1918, also known, weirdly, as the Spanish flu. It hit Kansas City really hard. 2,000-some people died of the flu in Kansas City that year. So now, as people here in town scramble for last-minute flu shots if they don't already have them, the obvious question is, what's in store for 2018 on into 2019? My guest for that is Dana Hawkinson. He's an infectious disease doctor from KU Med, and you can call 816-235-2888 with questions for him. Hi, Dana.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. How about you?
Good.
Is this a busy time of year already for you?
It's beginning to be.
So what's the flu looking like so far this year?
Well, unfortunately, we don't know exactly what the projections will be. The last few influenza seasons have been relatively late starters, meaning starting maybe in January, December. Last year was an anomaly to the recent seasons in that there was information in early November saying the Southern Hemisphere influenza epidemic was really bad. We expect a bad year. So far, there hasn't been any word from the CDC on what they expect at this point in time.
Any particular symptoms? It's sort of interesting to me that every year's flu is just kind of a little bit different, it seems.
Yeah, the flu vaccine, what they anticipate as far as the strains are certainly a little bit different. The symptoms, unfortunately, are fairly general. And so the symptoms are consistent with other types of respiratory viral illnesses, the common cough and cold, things like fevers, chills, muscle aches, cough, things of that nature.
I read an article in Fortune magazine about how they make predictions about flu seasons, and it was pretty interesting. And in fact, you know, it looks like the CDC makes predictions every week for the coming week.
Probably as we get further into flu season, which typically is week 40 of the year to week 20 of the next year is the flu season. Again, last year, early in November, I believe they commented that they expect the flu season in 2017-2018 to be very bad based on the Southern Hemisphere epidemic. Again, at this point in time, I haven't seen any information about that.
How do we predict patterns for disease outbreaks in something as common and annual as the flu?
Yeah, it certainly is very, very difficult. Flu may be a little bit easier as we can track it from one hemisphere to the other because obviously our summer is the Southern Hemisphere's winter and the flu epidemic tends to go on at that point. And then as we get into the winter season, we get the flu epidemic.
So that's the bulk of it?
That's the bulk of it. And those numbers and those flu strains.
Well, I saw early 2018, so technically this year, but really last flu season, was the first year in more than a dozen years for widespread flu activity throughout the continental United States as opposed to certain regions.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you see so much variation from region to region? Is that politics again? That's sort of interesting to me.
I think that's just the nature of microbes. I think that's the nature of...
Wait, can you explain that, the nature of microbes?
Yeah, the viruses, they can do what they want. You know, we don't tell them where to go. There could also be reporting differences in there. People presenting to clinics, ERs, maybe they're not presenting as much, maybe they are. So there's a lot of variables in that kind of thing.
Does last year's experience have any bearing on this year, or is every season kind of its own animal?
I think every season is its own animal. We certainly look, unfortunately, we have to look retrospectively, whether it's, well, how good was the vaccine? Well, we have to look back at the previous year.
What can we say about last year?
Last year, they expected fairly low vaccine effectiveness based on the viruses and the way the vaccine was produced. It ended up being about 40% effective, meaning it will reduce your chance of getting influenza illness by 40%. But even getting the vaccine is proven to help reduce the severity of illness should you get influenza.
Huh. Okay, so that's what we learned from last year. How does that affect how we approach this year, how you and people in your field of infectious diseases approach this year?
Yeah, I think we need to approach it from a manner of at any one point in time or any one season, we expect that it can be bad. You know, expect the worst, but hope for the best. That means promote good health practices. That means promoting good vaccination rates, promoting hand hygiene. All those things help reduce influenza infection, but also severity from influenza.
Call 816-235-2888 with your questions about the flu, perhaps even based on your own experience. Dana, what are the biggest misconceptions you hear about the flu itself or the vaccine?
Flu illness, again, people think maybe they had some nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, GI bug, typically gastrointestinal, calling that the flu. That's not influenza. Influenza tends to be a respiratory disease. The other biggest issue is I'm not going to get influenza vaccine because I got the flu. Influenza vaccine does not cause influenza illness. It is a killed or inactivated virus. So it basically just helps to prime your immune system to be ready should you encounter influenza virus.
The thing about the respiratory symptoms that I wonder about is why is that different from why is that not the same thing as what we call a respiratory infection in that case? What's the difference?
Well, it is a respiratory infection. However, there are numerous viruses which cause respiratory infections. The common cold is caused by two or three common viruses, and a lot of them can present in the same way as influenza. I mean, they're all affecting your sinuses, your lungs. They can all cause fever, body aches, things of that nature.
What about the way that the flu spreads? What can you tell us about that? I mean, you obviously are an expert in the spread of all kinds of diseases, but common knowledge about that might not be quite where science's knowledge of it is.
Yeah, influenza spread on very tiny particles or droplets. So you're coughing, sneezing, you know, respiratory secretions then come out. They can land on what we call fomites or inanimate objects, tabletops, things of that nature. And since they are so small, you know, even the gauze mask we were talking about in the last segment, they probably flew right through the gauze mask like a sieve. And then you can either pick it up by being directly exposed to some of those respiratory droplets, whether you inhale them or they get in your eyes, or if you touch surfaces where maybe those are. And we tend to touch our face quite a bit, our eyes, nose, mouth. And when you do that, that's a way that influenza virus can get into our body and then obviously cause infection.
Okay, so I'm imagining, you know, I understand kind of best practices for preventing spread of the flu, like when you're out and about in the world. But if, I mean, people who share homes with each other, is there any hope? There's some dispute about that within my household, about whether you can actually like hope to not get the flu from someone you share a house with.
Yeah, that's very difficult. Again, you're in close quarters. You probably are sharing some of the same things, door handles, faucet knobs. And so you're going to be touching a lot of the same surfaces. We unconsciously and inadvertently touch our face in many times a day. And that's why hand hygiene, washing your hands or using alcohol gel is so important because we don't even know we're touching our eyes or putting our hands in our mouth. But we are doing that, and that's how a lot of times we can come into contact with influenza virus. The same thing as if you're out, say, at an airport or at church or at the grocery store. There's just so many surfaces that people can touch.
So, you know, we try doing these things like covering our coughs and mm-hmm. washing our hands mm-hmm. as religiously as we can mm-hmm. without acquiring a second diagnosis, mm-hmm. as I might put it. But so what about, are there other prevention methods that people don't seem as knowledgeable about? Or is that kind of it, like age-old wisdom, wash your hands, cover your cough, and hope for the best?
And get vaccinated.
And stay home when you start noticing symptoms, right?
Yeah, those are really the simplest things to do and most common and have the most effect on reducing our chance of getting infected.
So are there popular prevention methods that do nothing?
I'm not sure. I mean, I would have to be given them. I don't know.
So, yeah, I guess.
For example.
We'll let our listeners let us know if there's a prevention method that they favor, okay. And then we can run those past you. But what about, so flu shots, are people seeming to get them in high numbers this year, or did last year's low effectiveness rate scare people off?
I think it varies year to year. Certainly, we promote it as much as possible. A lot of workplaces have mandatory or very strongly encouraged vaccination practices. I think that's the most important thing, is to try to continue to promote the positives of vaccination.
You mentioned the misconception about how it works, that it gives you the flu, mm-hmm. but just like a little bit. Mm-hmm. Can you explain how it does work in a little bit more detail?
Yeah. The antigens or epitopes or pieces on the influenza virus, when given in the vaccine, our body sees those pieces, will create antibodies to that specific piece or area, and that's how we gain production from antibody, or that's how we gain protection, is from the antibody production from that vaccine.
So then that has to require some knowledge about the strain that we're going to see this year. And that comes, does mm-hmm. that come from this whole thing of like it would be in the southern hemisphere before mm-hmm. being in the northern hemisphere?
Yeah, that's difficult too. Unfortunately, it takes time to produce the vaccine. So the intelligent people at the CDC and the World Health Organization try to be one step ahead and anticipate what is the flu vaccine, or sorry, what is the influenza virus that is circulating now in the southern hemisphere? What do we anticipate will be the northern hemisphere virus in 6 months? So now we're going to try to produce that.
How do they do that, though? I mean, because that they're sort of putting themselves in the mind of a virus or something. Mm-hmm. Like, how is this thing going to adapt and evolve over the course of about 6 months?
Yeah.
How do you do that?
Correct. And the influenza virus can adapt really quickly. I think that's just mathematical modeling, current strains, recent history of viruses. There's a number of different details that go into that.
What should people expect of a flu shot, and what maybe is an unreasonable expectation?
Physically, they should expect just a little bit of soreness afterward. Most people do not have any real significant reactions to the vaccine, although some have occurred in small numbers. Overall, you should expect to, number one, hopefully protect against infection.
Yourself.
Correct. Anywhere from, you know, maybe 30 to 40% reduction in the chance of getting illness. And then should you get it, expect a reduced severity of disease from that. In addition, getting it will also help reduce the chance that you're going to be spreading it to loved ones as well.
So, I mean, that's kind of my question. Is the idea really to prevent something like what happened in 1918 rather than mm-hmm. to prevent myself personally from getting sick?
It's dual. It's for yourself as well as for the people around you.
That story about what happened in 1918 everywhere, but really in a pronounced way here in Kansas City, have we seen anything like that since?
Not that I'm aware of. I think that was a different time, a different era. That virus happened to be extremely deadly. Just a different set of circumstances.
Can you talk a little bit about treatment and taking care of yourself if you do get the flu? Because, mm-hmm. you know, you hear about people going to the emergency room and mm-hmm. it being really like a life-saving thing. But, of course, not everyone who sees a symptom needs to do that. How do you know?
Right. I think it, again, boils down to individual. Because, again, in that time, there's also other cough or cold viruses that are circulating now during influenza season as well. I think it's a matter of knowing yourself, knowing what your symptoms are. Do you think you're getting better? If not, it may be time to present to a healthcare provider. But also, is there somebody else that is sick, you know, in your close quarters, in your household or at your school that you know has been diagnosed with influenza? And that way, getting in as early as possible or calling your healthcare provider and getting on treatment as early as possible.
So getting fast help, regardless of whether it's with your provider or at the ER or wherever, is important.
Yeah, because, you know, we don't know who can die from this disease. Certainly, historically, the very young and the very old, but also pregnant women are very at risk of severe complications and death from this. Recently, also in the past flu seasons, we've seen just otherwise young, healthy people who have had serious complications and who die or very close to death and have had extended stays in the hospital and have had extended problems and complications from this.
Well, Dana Hawkinson, thank you so much for sharing that information, and we'll check back in with you as the season progresses.
Sounds good.
Dana joined us from the University of Kansas Health System. Keep talking about the flu on Twitter. We're at KCURCST. Up next, TV technology for the digital age. It actually goes back to the mid-20th century, and the story behind it is pretty crazy. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now I'm here with Benjamin Gross of the Linda Hall Library. He's written a book about a team of researchers at RCA in the middle of the 20th century. They developed the technology behind the little screens we all carry in our pockets, a technology that once sounded absolutely insane to just about everyone, LCD technology. That stands for liquid crystal display. Did you know that? The screens a lot of us stare at all day long have become so commonplace, it's easy to forget just how crazy they once seemed and honestly still kind of do. Benjamin Gross is here to remind us. Hi, Benjamin.
Hello.
So your book is a really fascinating look at both the details of LCD technology and how it works, and also, more importantly, the human story of how that technology was both discovered and then transformed into products. It's called The TVs of Tomorrow. What inspired you to write it?
Well, originally, it was luck. I was a graduate student in Princeton, and I was looking for a research paper topic for my second year seminar, essentially. And it happened to be convenient that I lived a few miles down the road from RCA's technical archive. They had their central research laboratory in Princeton, and although RCA no longer exists, they went out of business in the 1980s, the archive was still there. All the old technical reports, laboratory notebooks, photographs, all this amazing material just sitting a few miles down the road from me. So I went down there in search of a research paper topic, and I talked with the director of the library at the time, and I said, I'm looking for a topic. Do you have any suggestions? And he said, how about LCDs? And I said, how about LCDs? I know what these things are. I had a laptop computer. I knew about flat screen TVs. I knew about LCD wristwatches and calculators. But I had no idea they had a connection to RCA or to New Jersey, which is where I was. And he explained to me that that was where they were invented, in the building where the archive was housed.
It seems pretty crazy to me just how early people were talking about a flat television. That, I mean, I think of that as kind of a transformation that's occurred within my lifetime, not as something that people in olden days were like working on already.
Yeah, they were already thinking about it as early as the 1950s. My book starts in 1951 when David Sarnoff, who was the chairman of RCA, got up and gave a speech where he actually asked his research staff to develop what he referred to as a light amplifier, which he claimed would enable the creation of TV screens of any size and maybe enable the creation of a TV that could hang on the wall like a picture.
It's so amazing that someone said that in 1951.
Well, Sarnoff had a reputation as a bit of a visionary. He was one of these people who would go out there and regularly make predictions about the types of technologies that would be developed in the next 10 or 15 years. And he always liked to say that it was vital to invest in research and development because that was the way to avoid obsolescence, right? If you're a company like RCA, everybody's going to go out eventually and buy black and white TVs, so you need to come up with a replacement technology. The first thing they came up with as a replacement was color television. And the thought was eventually everybody would buy a color TV, so what would be next? And Sarnoff's idea was maybe a flat screen TV.
So this is partly, and you're sort of getting at this now, about innovation and what fosters it or makes it possible. And there's this idea about a linear research and development type model. And then there's also this very currently popular idea that innovation is all about disruption. Can you explain what that has to do with this story? Because I think that's kind of the heart of the drama here.
It's true. What you're describing is what historians have sometimes referred to as the linear model. The idea is that if you put a lot of money into basic research and development, then over time that will result in new technologies. That idea underlay the development of research laboratories like RCA Labs in Princeton or Bell Labs up in Murray Hill, New Jersey. It's kind of this classic 1950s, 1960s, give people enough money and time and resources to do blue sky research, and eventually useful technologies will shake out of that. Later on, however, there came to be this kind of skepticism that emerged by the end of the 1960s that maybe this was not the best way to invest research funds. Perhaps it would be better to do more targeted research with applications in mind. At the same time, you have the development of a new mindset that really comes into its own in Silicon Valley with firms like Intel, where you don't have a separate blue sky fundamental research organization. The research and development is happening in the same facility as the application development is going on. So you don't have that same kind of gamble where you're investing tons and tons of money and resources in order to hope that something will come out of it. You're doing something a little bit more focused. And some people would argue that that is the development of our kind of modern notion of disruption. Larger companies like RCA or Bell Labs or IBM, or you could go on, these very large established companies, were basically seen as too slow to react to changes in the market. They were seen as reluctant to invest in technologies that were outside of their core business. The LCD is a great example of this, right? Early on, the LCD was not advanced enough to really make a television, even though that would have been what RCA really wanted. Instead, they saw it as kind of a side project, a small thing with a limited market that didn't really merit extended investment. And that's when you have personnel from RCA ultimately leave the company to start a spinoff. And it was one of these really interesting things. I hadn't realized that there were spinoff companies, for example, on the East Coast, and that one of these spinoff companies actually succeeded where RCA failed in making a commercially successful product. The first LCD wristwatch was developed at an RCA spinoff called Optel.
So the lesson here is what? I mean, we'll get into the details of the story, but the lesson is, it seems like the lesson is partly like having a separate wing that's just doing like tangential research is not the same as just supporting and throwing the funds into what's happening with your, it seems like there's kind of a rift between sort of like a management level researcher and then the more sciencey people.
So one of the big things that I tried to emphasize in this story is that management doesn't make decisions in a vacuum. Often when people look at the LCD story, the story that I tell in my book, they point to it as a kind of failure story, right? They say RCA came up with this amazing new technology, the LCD, and then they failed to commercialize it. Oh, I guess I should say spoilers for anyone who hasn't read the book. They failed to commercialize the technology. And then they say, well, whose fault is it? Well, the scientists can't be to blame. They came up with the technology. Clearly, it's management's fault. And there's some truth to that, but management didn't make its decision all on its own. They don't have firsthand knowledge of the technology or how it works. They are consulting with scientists and engineers, the people who are in the laboratories and the factories who are familiar with the capacity of this technology to do various things. So one of the things I really wanted to emphasize in the book is that scientists and engineers can play an important role, both positive and negative, in the creation of R&D policy within a company.
So the book opens with a press conference that was convened in 1968. Can you kind of set the scene at that press conference for our listeners?
Definitely. Some of your listeners are probably familiar with the TV show 30 Rock, which is set in New York City at 30 Rockefeller Center. That was the headquarters of RCA back in the 1960s. RCA actually, among other things, helped to establish the first radio broadcasting network, a company that is still around in one form or another called NBC. And in 1968, at the end of May, a group of reporters were invited to 30 Rock for this press conference. They received a press kit with a release inside that described all sorts of amazing technologies that would be possible thanks to this paradoxically named set of materials called liquid crystals, which at that point, no one had ever heard of.
So explain what those are, because as much as we all sort of casually refer to LCD screens, I actually didn't realize until reading this book that that refers to liquid crystals, and that and I had never thought about the idea that liquid crystals is really like that phrase doesn't make sense intuitively.
No, it doesn't. And in fact, there had been research on liquid crystals for about 80 years before the announcement that RCA made in New York. But they were still seen as really obscure and not especially well-known to anyone outside of a chemistry graduate program. So for those who are unfamiliar, liquid crystals are materials that behave partly like a liquid and partly like a solid crystal. And here's what I mean by that. They can flow and take the shape of their container, like a liquid. But if you were to shine light through them, they would refract that light kind of like a solid crystal. It implies a degree of molecular organization a little bit more than a regular liquid.
So that's how these screens that we all use today really work, is this liquid crystal concept where it flows like a liquid and then reflects light like crystals depending on what is shown at it.
True, though there's a little bit more than that. Essentially, what RCA is demonstrating, and then later scientists build upon, is the notion that some of these liquid crystals, not all of them, but some of them, if you apply an electric field to them, if you basically apply a voltage across them, they will scatter light, or they'll do other things. So, for example, the liquid crystals in your TV or your flat-screen monitor, they will actually line up, the molecules will line up in new ways that will allow you to modulate the passage of light.
So in 1968, a bunch of reporters head to 30 Rockefeller Center to find out about liquid crystals. What were they already able to learn in 1968?
The reporters show up and they look at this press release, and it describes things that no one could possibly believe. Think things like an electronic clock with no moving parts whatsoever, right? No hands, no clockwork, nothing. Right. They describe in this press release a window that you could push a button and it would go from clear to opaque to provide privacy instantly. When they go through and there's an actual presentation before they unveil some of these prototypes, one of the reporters describes the possibility of, get this, a portable flat screen television that you could take to the beach, which sounded really outlandish because at that point, some people listening to this may remember, televisions relied on these very big, bulky cathode ray tubes. They were
extremely
heavy.
Yeah, they had those like back compartments.
Exactly. Even if you got a relatively small TV or a computer monitor, it could take up the entirety of a table or a desk. But here they were describing something that you could take potentially, you know, on the road, that would be battery powered and that you could watch a ball game, for example.
So did people think they were crazy, or did people think, okay, it's RCA saying it, this is legit?
So what they said initially, well, I can't say what they said initially while they were in the room, but I can say that after they watched some of these demonstrations, they were very excited. So RCA comes out and they bring out a couple of displays. Some of them are relatively simple, like they figure out a way to make a television test pattern, right? So you push a button and it goes from a clear glass pane to bright white, and it looks like a really detailed test pattern, which suggests you could make all sorts of static images pretty easily. They bring out the all-electronic clock, which worked really well for the entirety of the press conference, and then, at least according to one of the people who was there, stopped working right after the reporters took pictures of it, which said something about kind of whether or not they were ready for prime time, right? They also had a device that could mimic the behavior of a couple of lines of a TV picture. They couldn't scale it up to a full-size display, but they showed that they could do grayscale pixels, about 36 of them, at enough speed that you could potentially make a moving image out of it if you could scale it up.
Okay, so I know you wrote a whole book about this, but are you able to give like a short version of the story of how this technology came about, like the human story there leading up to the press conference? And then we'll get to the whole product development and beating out competing display technologies.
Sure.
After that.
All right. So here's the quick version of how we get to 1968. In 1951, David Sarnoff gives this speech that I mentioned earlier where he hints at the possibility of a television that could hang on the wall. Without going into too much detail on that, his scientists and engineers try their best. They come up with a couple of ideas. They never really go any further than that. But the idea continues to float around. And if you're at RCA in the 1950s and 1960s and you're working on new technologies that might be able to make a flat screen display, people know that that would be of interest to people higher up in the company. Now, one of the people who was working on this idea was a physical chemist named Richard Williams, who had been doing a bunch of these kind of blue sky experiments we mentioned earlier, essentially seeing what would happen to crystals when you apply a voltage across them. And when he did that, he discovered ultimately that certain liquid crystals could block the passage of light. He ultimately does not succeed in persuading his supervisors that that's something worth pursuing. He sets it aside. And another one of his colleagues, a gentleman named George Heilmeier, an electrical engineer, later picks up where Williams leaves off, finds a new electro-optic effect, which he refers to as dynamic scattering, which essentially you take a different class of liquid crystals, you apply even more voltage to it, and it makes the light scatter really, really effectively, going from clear to kind of milky white. It's very striking. And Heilmeier then goes to his bosses and says, we need to turn this into a display. And his bosses say, that's great. We're going to start a top secret project. And for the next few years, you and a growing number of chemists and physicists and electrical engineers and technicians will all be involved in trying to turn this into something practical.
So this is like the Manhattan Project of TVs.
A little bit, yeah. Although, really, RCA had done this sort of thing before. In fact, when they were developing color television, they went even more intensively into creating a Manhattan Project type kind of effort to really rush the development of the technology.
So talk to me about the decision RCA made to go public with this technology at this particular stage in 1968. This has to do with the commercial world more than the scientific world, right?
So there were a couple of different reasons, I think, that they decided to go public. One big one is that RCA had finally started to secure its intellectual property portfolio surrounding the technology. The company had a long and deep appreciation of patents. They controlled a large number of radio and television patents and were licensing them out. They knew that a lot of companies were eager to get into the radio and television games, so they would license their patents and use the royalties from those patents to support research, which would then generate more patents, which would then generate more revenue, and so forth. So RCA, by 1968, had started to compile a patent portfolio surrounding liquid crystal technology. There was also a real symbolic value to this. RCA was going through a bit of a leadership change. The company's longtime chairman, David Sarnoff, had stepped down. His son, Robert Sarnoff, had come in to take over. And there was some concern that Robert Sarnoff might not be as supportive of the research labs as his father, who had a very close tie to the technical side of RCA, had been.
But if the public gets really excited...
Precisely. And if you pick a project that is very clearly interdisciplinary and relied on a well-funded research lab, so much the better.
So you have mentioned David Sarnoff a few times, and he is maybe a more compelling character than we've even already come to understand. He's this guy who, as far as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, he really just has this imagined idea of a flat TV. He doesn't know what technology will make it possible. He doesn't even have a clue about that, but he imagines it and states it and kind of sets other people's imaginations into motion, people who can invent that thing. What is his story? Who is he?
David Sarnoff could be the subject, and he has been the subject, of several other books. He was a Russian immigrant who came to the United States knowing absolutely no English, and by the time he was 30 years old, essentially, he was already on his way to being the leader of a company, the largest consumer electronics company in the United States. He essentially worked his way from being an office boy at the Marconi Wireless Telegraph Company to the commercial vice president of RCA when it was founded in 1919, then president by 1930. So I guess technically he was 40 years old, not 30 years old, sorry. and then chairman of the company by World War One. World War II. Jeez.
There's also another character who's pretty intriguing, Elmer Engstrom, and his role in this, and we haven't heard his name yet.
Elmer Engstrom was the president, or rather the vice president of RCA Laboratories, and then eventually he became the president of the company. He was essentially the person who was in charge of the research labs where the liquid crystal development was being done.
How do the dynamics between someone like a David Sarnoff and someone like an Elmer Engstrom result in technologies either advancing or not?
Well, it turns out those two got along really well because they both came up through the technical side of the company. Engstrom was involved in the early development of television. Sarnoff always tried to familiarize himself with the technical workings of at least radio and television, and to maintain good relations with the researchers at the company's various laboratories and operating divisions. So it turned out that Engstrom and Sarnoff were kind of on the same wavelength. And when Sarnoff said any of his predictions, whenever he would give a speech predicting something, he often would consult with Engstrom in advance so that he would have a sense of what was achievable. Right. So he's not just making predictions blindly, but he's also leaving a little bit of ambiguity in there so the researchers could have a bit of flexibility in their pursuit of the objective.
As someone who works in the world of science, can you help me understand, is that a rarity to have that kind of dynamic and that importance of kind of guiding based on what's possible, but not limiting the imagination?
Well, I'm more of a historian than a scientist, but I think that we can see a lot of examples of kind of strong collaborations between people who are more on the visionary side and people who are more on the technical side, right? And it's important to have both if you are trying to make significant technical advances. Ideally, you'd have someone with a little bit of knowledge of each, right? The capacity to recognize what is possible, right, without going too far down the rabbit hole. Right, is extremely useful. At the same time, you need someone like an Engstrom or his successor, Jim Hillier, to help kind of manage the day-to-day operations of the research operation.
Is there a particular milestone in the advancement of LCD technology that you think of as like, this is when it went from smoke and mirrors to like, there's something substantial here, and everyone knew it.
So one could argue that 1972 or so, when the first LCD wristwatch was unveiled, that was a big deal. Another great example, and one that I cite in my book, is that in 1988, Sharp, the electronics company in Japan, produced a 14-inch color flat-screen LCD TV. And that was the first time that people had seen a TV that was comparable in size and picture quality to something they might have in their house. That really was that that flat screen that David Sarnoff predicted years before could eventually hang on the wall like a painting.
With the whole process, you know, part of the story is that this is now like the dominant display technology of the digital age. And it's not just a matter of what televisions people have in their houses or what watches people wear, if they wear watches at all anymore, because this technology has in some ways eliminated the need for those. But also, like, you know, you mentioned monitors and phones and so many other things.
Look around you today and you will see that we live in a world of screens. And what's really interesting to me is that we can trace the origins of those screens not back to East Asia, where many of those are produced today, or to Europe, or even to Silicon Valley, but all the way back to the East Coast. I sometimes joke that before Silicon Valley, there was New Jersey.
Well, our time is up, but Benjamin Gross, with us from the Linda Hall Library, thank you for sharing your new book, The TVs of Tomorrow.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You can revisit this conversation or anything from today's show at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. And you can have all these conversations sent to you and listen to them on your own time like a podcast. Sign up for that while you're there, kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we'll be talking about why predicting the weather in Kansas City is so hard. We've even got a naysayer on that. It's a roundtable of meteorologists talking shop about The Challenges of Kansas City. That's tomorrow. Don't miss it. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Chris Young, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer, and I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next on KCUR.